This week on The Score, a presidential scholar reflects on the late George H.W. Bush. 77 years later, we remember Pearl Harbor. A lawyer explains how the Library of Congress violates the First Amendment. Our film critic wonders if we misunderstand Ebenezer Scrooge. All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. This week, America and the world bade farewell to President George H.W. Bush, who died at age 94 on November 30th. The Score reached out to presidential scholar Barbara Perry at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, who has edited a book about the Bush presidency. Earlier this year, in April, Dr. Perry was our guest to talk about former First Lady Barbara Bush. First, let's hear a brief excerpt from President Bush's 1992 State of the Union Address.
I pride myself that I'm a prudent man, and I believe that patience is a virtue, but I understand that politics is, for some, a game, and that sometimes the game is to stop all progress and then decry the lack of improvement. But let me tell you, far more important than my political future and far more important than yours is the well-being of our country. Members of this chamber are practical people, and I know you won't resent some practical advice. When people put their party's fortunes, whatever the party, whatever side of this aisle, before the public good, they court defeat, not only for their country, but for themselves. And they will certainly deserve it. And
a lot of people remember Dana Carvey's impression of George H.W. Bush on Saturday Night Live in the early 90s when he used the phrase, "wouldn't be prudent." Would you say that prudence is perhaps the most characteristic virtue of the late president?
I would, Rick. And I would say, as is typical of humor and good interpretation of a person by way of impersonation or caricatures that are drawn as cartoons, it usually takes a basic truth about how someone sounds or looks and it exaggerates it. So I think it's quite correct to say that, in a good way, prudence was a core value and a core characteristic of George H.W. Bush's persona, and it was just the way he said it and talked about it that Dana Carvey decided to zero in on so effectively in doing a humorous impersonation of Bush 41.
We're talking with Barbara Perry from the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Another aspect of the late president's life and his habits that has struck me was his thousands of handwritten thank you letters that he sent to friends, adversaries, foreign leaders. That seems so old-fashioned now, and yet it seems also like really effective politics.
Yes, the reason it seems old-fashioned is that we've lost the president at age 94. He lived almost a century, starting out in the first quarter of the 20th century, and he was very old school. You can't get any more almost literally old school by virtue of his going to Andover Press School and to Yale. But he was trained by a patrician father and mother to use those gestures of common decency and courtesy and sort of Emily Post etiquette. My mother always had an Emily Post volume at the ready and trained me on that as well. But you're right. That's old school. It has passed. people don't write handwritten notes typically anymore. They commit things to text or email. So it is an era that has passed with this president, and it makes me very sad.
You knew President Bush, is that correct?
I knew him a little bit. I knew him mostly through his public persona, but I did have a chance to see him, and I'd be grateful for this, last year at this time, on the public stage in person, at the Bush Library 20th anniversary celebration, when he appeared on stage with all of the other extant former presidents, to raise money at a concert for hurricane relief for the Houston area. And, he obviously was confined to his wheelchair, but you could just see him bursting with pride to be up there with his, fellow club members, the club, the very exclusive club of former presidents, including his own son, George Bush 43. So, in that sense, and the fact that we did the oral history of his administration, I do feel that I know him.
This is a question that not many people seem to be addressing over the past few days, but what was George Bush's role as vice president under Ronald Reagan? He spent 8 years as vice president, 4 years as president, and certainly his 4 years as president were quite turbulent. But what did Ronald Reagan want him to be as vice president?
Ronald Reagan wanted George Bush to be exactly what George Bush was, and that was a faithful acolyte of the Reagan administration, even though Ronald Reagan well knew that Bush did not represent the Reagan wing of the party. He knew that George Bush was the old and passing from the scene New England moderate wing of the Republican Party, which now almost doesn't exist. And again, sadly, Bush 41, in my view, sadly, takes that part of the party with him to his grave. So Ronald Reagan knew that it was balancing the ticket by geography, balancing the ticket by ideology. But I think he also had a sense that George Bush was a decent man, would be a loyal servant, and I think the epitome of that is the horrible day of the attempted assassination on President Reagan. Bush happened to be in Texas and was, of course, flown back immediately to Washington, and they said, we will land you on the South Lawn. We'll take you from Andrews by helicopter to the South Lawn. And George H.W. Bush, Vice President of the United States, said, only the president lands on the South Lawn. Please don't do that for me.
That's a real sense of propriety.
And proportion. And prudence.
And prudence. And it seems, from your description of how Reagan viewed Bush as a balance to his conservatism, when Bush picked his vice presidential candidate, Dan Quayle, it was about, he chose a conservative from the Midwest to balance his Eastern establishment moderate Republicanism.
Indeed, and a generational balance as well, a much younger man in Dan Quayle, a rising star at that time. People don't remember that because Dan Quayle didn't do much beyond the vice presidency, and he was somewhat ridiculed, probably very much unfairly, as vice president. But I think you're absolutely right that Bush, in that long tradition of balancing presidential, vice presidential nominees on the ticket, was doing just what Reagan had done with him.
I remember in the late 80s, early 90s, traveling in conservative Republican circles where people would say that Dan Quayle was the best person in the Bush administration.
Well, certainly among Reagan Republicans, and they were growing in numbers, and when Reagan did the deed of compromising on the 1990 budget and raising taxes, that part, the rising ascendant part of the Republican Party led by Reagan conservatives, he lost, as George Bush 43 said the other night in a documentary I saw, he said it was good policy for the country because we needed to have a closer to a balanced budget and it was good to compromise, but he said politically it was disastrous for his dad. And we know that it was that, along with the recession that was hitting and at its peak at just at the 92 election. It was disastrous. That and one element as well, Ross Perot being in the race as a third-party candidate.
And that was certainly not something that anyone could have predicted in 1988 or 89, that someone like Perot would come on the scene and throw a monkey wrench into the electoral process.
And ironically, remember, his one platform, his one plank in his platform was a balanced budget. And Bush actually tried to address that in the 1990 compromise with Democrats on the Hill, but he lost his own base.
And it took a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, to balance the budget a few years later.
It did, and not only balance it, but we, of course, in that golden era of the dot-com bubble, we ended up with surpluses.
We could probably talk for hours about how politics has changed over the past 25 years, but I'd like to end this conversation just by asking you about what was President Bush's governing style? How did he run the White House, and how did it differ from other presidents?
I think you can come back to the way we started, Rick, with the word prudence. Had a golden resume coming into the White House, probably the best prepared president we ever had, except perhaps for the founding fathers. And I would point to his foreign policy team, Brent Scowcroft, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Jim Baker. That was the A-plus team. And so the prudence that he demonstrated as a statesman in his own right, he surrounded himself with knowledgeable, experienced, and prudent advisors. And his style was the style that we know of, which was not only prudent, but courteous, kind, and forgiving. And that's what we miss, certainly, on today's political stage.
Well, with that, we'll say goodbye for now. I hope that the next time we talk, it's not on a sad occasion, as it has been the past couple of times that you've been a guest on The Score from Bering Drift. But Barbara Perry, thank you for taking time from your schedule this week, and thank you for joining us.
It's always an honor to be with you, Rick.
A Richmond publisher of old, rare, and esoteric books has fallen afoul of an obscure law. If the law is fully enforced, Valancourt Books could end up paying hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines to the Library of Congress, something that could easily put it out of business. Coming to the rescue is the Institute for Justice, a public interest law firm headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. I spoke to IJ attorney Bob McNamara about the lawsuit he has filed on behalf of Valancourt Books. You have an interesting case right now that has both First Amendment and Fifth Amendment implications. That's not a combination you usually see. Can you give me a little background on that?
Absolutely. Usually you don't see those together because when the government's taking property, the property usually isn't books. But in the case of Valancourt Books, a small publisher in Richmond, Virginia, the federal government has threatened the business with hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines for publishing books without sending free copies of them to the government every single time.
I'm at the Institute for Justice in Arlington, Virginia, talking to attorney Bob McNamara about this case. And when did this come to you? It's not the sort of thing that usually is on the radar of anybody in the media.
It's not on the radar of a lot of people in the media. To be frank, it's not on the radar of a lot of people in the publishing industry. I've talked to a lot of people in the publishing industry. They had no idea that there's a requirement on the books that says you're supposed to give the federal government a copy of every free book. And the guys at Valancourt didn't know. James Jenkins, who founded Valancourt, was out to dinner earlier this year when he got an email from the federal government demanding a single copy of 341 different Valancourt titles and threatening him with fines that could stretch over $800,000 if he failed to comply. And he simply had no idea this law even existed in the first place, and almost no one I've talked to had ever heard of it either.
And this law is a throwback to an early era of the printing press where the only kind of books you had were printed books, and the Library of Congress apparently wanted to increase its collections.
Well, so this requirement's been on the books for over 200 years, and it's really a relic of how the copyright system used to work. In order to get copyright protection 200 years ago, you had to first deposit your books with the federal government. You had to give a copy to a federal court clerk, actually, and then another to the executive branch. And if you didn't want to deposit your books, that was your business, but you didn't get the copyright protection. But that's not how copyright works anymore. Congress has amended copyright law to make clear that copyright attaches to anything you write. The minute you write it down, you have copyright in that thing you wrote. But they haven't removed the deposit requirement. And so that means this requirement that used to exist in order to ensure that people could apply for copyright protection just sort of lumbers on as a freestanding demand that anyone who publishes something in the United States is obligated to give a copy of it to the federal government free of charge.
And it seems to me that this requirement is an impediment to publishers who may want to go out and republish orphan materials that fell out of copyright 100 years ago, but nobody's bothered to print them since then. But this is going to scare them away from doing that sort of thing, especially if, like in Valancourt's case, they only sell about 100 copies of any single book.
That's exactly right. And Valancourt, I think, is a great example of that. Valancourt is devoted to bringing forgotten literature back to a wider audience. They publish a lot of out-of-print books. They revive a lot of gothic horror novels that are of academic importance but haven't been published in decades or even centuries in some case. And they're able to do this because of the wonders of modern technology. They would lose a lot of money if they had to print 10,000 copies of every single Valancourt book. But instead, they use print-on-demand technology. They lay out the books, they edit them, they recruit literature scholars to provide forewords and scholarly endnotes, and the book doesn't get physically printed until someone goes and actually orders a copy of the book. So they avoid having remaindered copies, they don't publish more than they need, and they're able to bring these books back to a wider audience so people can read them, keep them on their shelves, teach them in their college classes, all of which happens. Valancourt's very successful. And so when they got this demand to turn over all of these books or pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines, there were two problems. One, they don't have the books. These books don't exist that they're going to be fined for not turning over. But the other problem was these aren't even new books. And James Jenkins immediately wrote to the government and said, I'm not sure you understand what we do, but most of this is stuff from the 18th century, from even earlier, that's clearly out of copyright. And they wrote back, and it's very clear that to the extent Valancourt is adding scholarly footnotes, those footnotes are copyrightable. Someone wrote them in the modern era, and if you're publishing something copyrightable, the government apparently wants its cut on pain of crippling fines.
Are you aware of any other publishers who have faced these fines from the Library of Congress and perhaps just gave in and paid them?
Yes, so there have been at least three instances where threat letters weren't enough and there was a move towards actually suing people for fines. And in two of them, the publisher just settled and gave in. In the third, the publisher actually went to court, lost, and was fined. And so the laws are enforced, though for the most part they seem to be enforced haphazardly. I've talked to a lot of smaller people in the publishing industry, and they have no idea this is a requirement. Some of them send their books to the Library of Congress voluntarily, because if you send a book to the Library of Congress, you can get a Library of Congress control number, a catalog number that people like to have for a variety of reasons. But that actually doesn't count. James also wrote and said, you know, I've actually deposited a number of my books in the Library of Congress. That's part of the federal government. Doesn't that count? And they said, no, when you sent us those books, that was in exchange for your catalog number. We're entitled to these books in exchange for nothing. And because you got something for that, that doesn't count as complying with the law.
And this is part of a wide web of obscure, largely unenforced but enforceable laws that affect every American.
That's absolutely right. When something in the private sector ceases to have any use, people generally abandon it and it goes away. When something in the U.S. Code fails to have any use, it stays in the U.S. Code and it can be enforced. And this law, as far as we can tell, no one decided to keep the mandatory deposit on the books. They kept the mandatory deposit on the books because the last time they went through and amended the copyright code, it didn't come up. They just removed all of these requirements about notices of copyright and didn't touch the mandatory deposit requirement. But nonetheless, there are people sitting in Washington, D.C., whose job it is, apparently, to troll through the internet. It's still not clear to me how they found Valancourt or what they do, but to go hunting for people who are out of compliance and send them these letters that are, if you're on the receiving end of them, are devastating. I mean, James is sitting at dinner, and his company is two people. It is him and his husband, and they have published over 300 books, and they're beloved by the people who love them, but this is not a multi-million dollar industry. They're supporting themselves doing work they love, but it's a passion project. And to suddenly be told you either have to come up with more than 300 books that you don't have, or you have to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars, which you also don't have, is terrifying. And for federal government officials to send threats like that to private citizens for doing nothing wrong doing beyond just publishing books, doing something that we should all be celebrating, is outrageous. And I think it goes to the fact that we need to be very careful about what laws we actually pass, and we need to devote a little more attention to repealing laws that are on the books instead of just leaving these restrictions out there as landmines to go off in the face of people like James Jenkins.
Is there anyone in Congress who's aware of this who may be interested in amending the law so that companies like Valancourt Press no longer have to face these kinds of penalties?
Well, we haven't had any contact with Congress, but fortunately, the guys at Valancourt are passionate and they are committed. And the lawsuit we have filed here in the Federal District Court for the District of Columbia is designed to do exactly that. It's designed to get a court order that says not only does Valancourt not have to pay these fines, but nobody is required to give the government free copies of their books or indeed their property. The fundamental claim in this case is that you have a property right in your books, and the government isn't allowed to simply point a finger at you and say, hey, give me that. And a ruling in this case will protect not just Valancourt, it will prevent this law from being enforced generally, and it will prevent anyone like James from ever getting a letter like that in the future.
I'm curious how this case came to the attention of the Institute for Justice. Did James Jenkins come to you, or did you find him?
James Jenkins found us. James is, as you might expect from someone whose life passion is resurrecting books that literally no one else has heard of, is a thorough researcher. He's actually a trained attorney. He practiced law for several years while Valancourt was getting running, actually. He quit practicing law once Valancourt got up to the speed where he could support himself publishing books. But for several years, he was both a practicing lawyer, and in the evenings, he would go home and physically by hand retype 18th century horror novels that he would publish. So he is, as you might expect, good at finding things out. And he got the letter and instantly had the intuitive reaction and also the lawyer's reaction of, wait a minute, you're punishing me for not giving you my stuff for free. I thought there were rules about making people give away stuff for free. And when you look into property rights, you find the Institute for Justice as the premier defender of them. So he reached out to us, and I had never heard of this law. No one here had heard of this law. But it is very much on the cutting edge of sort of the constitutional law of property rights and how the prohibition against government takings applies to situations like this, where the government's not taking Valancourt's land. It's taking Valancourt's personal property. It's saying, we demand you give us your books. And that is something the courts have recently started to take a great deal of interest in. And I think that's part of what makes this, from the constitutional perspective, such an exciting case and such an important precedent to be able to establish.
That's a good segue into my final question, which is, how does this case fit into IJ's overall mission?
Well, this is at the heart of protecting property rights. IJ has been defending private property rights from eminent domain, has been defending private property rights from civil forfeiture for years, and this allows us to move into this slightly different but closely related cutting-edge area of takings law about these different governmental programs that all rest on requiring businesses to turn over personal property, not physically occupying their land, but insisting that farmers hand over part of their raising crop, insisting publishers hand over part of the books they publish. There are a number of programs like this, all similarly outdated, but all resting on the premise that there's something different and there's something more acceptable if instead of taking your farm, the government takes the raisins you grow on your farm. And that's simply not true. And courts are increasingly recognizing that this isn't true. And so this is an area where there's been a lot of litigation. And this case allows us to remain on the forefront of innovative property rights claims as we move forward into the brave new century.
Well, what's the next step in this particular case? Where are you in the court process?
So we are in the trial court. The government has not asked the court to dismiss the case. And so right now we're in the midst of discovery. We're going to be taking a deposition, possibly of the person who sent the threatening letter to James, or possibly of his boss. We're going to work that out. But we expect by spring to ask the court to issue a ruling in our favor, and we should hear on that by late summer or early fall. So we're pushing forward aggressively, and we are very confident in the outcome, not just for James, but for everyone else who publishes books for a living, or indeed everyone who just owns books.
Well, we'll be looking for more news on this matter. Bob McNamara, thank you for joining us on The Score from Bering Drift. I appreciate this opportunity to be here again at the Institute for Justice.
Thanks for having me.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
It's the holiday season, which means there are multiple ways to read, hear, or see Charles Dickens' classic story, A Christmas Carol. The Score's film critic, Tim Halsey, examines this ubiquitous work and detects a ghost of an idea in Dickens' socially conscious mind.
I have endeavored in this ghostly little book to raise the ghost of an idea which shall not put my readers out of humor with themselves, with each other, with the season, or with me. May it haunt their houses pleasantly, and no one wish to lay it. Thus in 1843, Charles Dickens introduced perhaps his most famous work, A Christmas Carol. This ghost story of Christmas, which takes a little over an hour to read and can be found nearly anywhere, reshaped the way we celebrate Christmas and has become a major part of every holiday season since. This year alone, Virginians have live theatrical productions of A Christmas Carol in Norfolk, Stanton, Alexandria, and Williamsburg, plus a musical version in Blacksburg. If that's not enough, there's an annual production of A Christmas Carol at Ford's Theater in Washington, D.C., and film versions in cinemas and on television, from the 1938 MGM film to the 1951 British classic with Alastair Sim. Animated Christmas Carols feature stars as varied as Walter Matthau and Jim Carrey. There are live-action television films with Patrick Stewart and George C. Scott. There's even A Christmas Carol with Michael Caine and the Muppets. What tends to get lost in all these versions and manifestations of A Christmas Carol is the story itself, and most of all, the ghost of an idea that Charles Dickens hoped to impart to his readers. We don't pay that much attention to Ebenezer Scrooge before he meets the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and yet to come, but perhaps we should. Dickens writes that Scrooge's name was good on change, the exchange was the stock market of Dickens's day, for anything he chose to put his hand to. Dickens endows Scrooge with a number of disagreeable traits, his want of sympathy, his desire to keep other people at a distance. He writes that Scrooge, quote, carried his own low temperature always about with him, he iced his office in the dog days, and didn't thaw at 1 degree at Christmas. But before he mentions any of this, he tells us that Scrooge is honest by habit and reputation. It should come as no surprise, then, that Scrooge's favorite epithet appears to be humbug, which means a phony, a fake, or a fraud. And when the ghost of Christmas past displays the parade of miseries that constitute the bulk of Scrooge's holiday memories, it's easy to see why he might get such an idea. When his nephew wishes him a Merry Christmas, Scrooge practically explodes. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older but not an hour richer? A time for balancing your books and having every item in 'em through a round dozen of months presented dead against you. Given what we know of Scrooge's occupation, that's a pretty harsh indictment. Dickens says that Scrooge works in an accounting house. Today we'd say that he worked in the financial industry. And we know from one of the shadows presented by the ghost of Christmas yet to come that at least one of Scrooge's duties is debt collection. Many stage and film adaptations have presumed that Scrooge must be in the money-lending business, perhaps as a mortgage broker, a payday lender, or a loan shark, squeezing his poor clients for exorbitant interest. In some film and stage versions of the Dickens story, Scrooge proclaims at the end that all debts owed to him are canceled. But none of that comes out of Dickens's story itself. As an accountant, a debt collector, or a broker, Scrooge would have issued loans with his clients' money or collected outstanding debts on behalf of his clients. In either case, forgiving those debts would almost certainly involve defrauding his investors. But back to the matter at hand. The detail that stands out most from the pre-Reformation Scrooge is his curt dismissal of the two men, portly gentlemen, Dickens calls them, who are collecting for charity. Scrooge asks if the prisons and workhouses are operating and states, "I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. They cost enough, and those who are badly off must go there." Prisons and workhouses were the Victorian welfare state, the workfare and welfare of their time. Dickens, throughout his career, called attention to the inadequacy of state-run charity, like the orphanage in Oliver Twist, where growing boys are begrudged each bowl of gruel. Government charity in Dickens always proves inadequate, not because of funding, but because charitable institutions provided by the state, as one of the portly gentlemen puts it, quote, "scarcely furnish Christian cheer of mind or body to the multitude." When the charity collector mentions that many people would rather die than stoop to a prison or a workhouse, Scrooge makes his most callous remark, one he will soon regret. "If they would rather die," said Scrooge, "they had better do it and decrease the surplus population." But that's not where the exchange ends. Scrooge goes on, "Besides, excuse me, I don't know that." "But you might know it," observed the gentleman. There, in a nutshell, is Dickens's ghost of an idea. the answer to human misery lies not in larger, ever-expanding government programs, not in more prisons, larger orphanages, or more technologically sophisticated workhouses. Rather, the answer is in voluntary acts of charity. So when we see a Red Kettle this year, a food bank, or a clothing drive, let's keep Dickens' ghost of an idea in mind. It's a Christmas invitation to all of us to help furnish that cheer of mind and body to those who need it most, and get to know our fellow man, and ourselves, a little better.
Happy Hanukkah from The Score with Rick Sincere.
When The Score returns, we'll look back at the attack on Pearl Harbor, which took place 77 years ago this week, with historian Craig Shirley. And in a look to the future, I talked to University of Virginia student Harrison Premen about the campus group Students for Individual Liberty. The Score will be right back. Stay tuned.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at ricksincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit beringdrift.com.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary.
That was how CBS announcer John Charles Daly brought the news to Americans on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, that the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor had been attacked by the Japanese. Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm Rick Sincere. A few years ago, Craig Shirley, a biographer and associate of President Ronald Reagan, wrote a book called December 1941, which offers a day-by-day account of that transformative month. When he came to the Virginia Festival of the Book in 2014, I asked him about the book and his interest in the history of World War II. First, however, I wanted to find out something about President Reagan. Craig Shirley, welcome to Bering Drift Radio.
Thank you.
And welcome to Charlottesville for the Virginia Festival of the Book. Before I ask you a few questions about your book, December 1941, I just want to ask a couple political questions.
Okay, sure.
You're a long associate of President Ronald Reagan.
Well, yes, but at a very low level.
Right. And you've written about him.
Mm-hmm.
I saw you speak at CPAC maybe 3 or 4 years ago, and somebody asked you a question about Ronald Reagan as a libertarian.
Right.
And I just wanted to see if you could kind of talk about that a bit.
Sure. He gave an interview to Reason magazine in 1975. Reason, of course, is the libertarian publication, in which he said that libertarianism was the fundamental basis for American conservatism. He, for a time, referred to himself publicly as a libertarian conservative. I have interviews of him on CBS in which he referred to himself as a libertarian conservative. He was not libertine, but he was very much of the opinion in the following Locke, Paine, and Jefferson, that it was about the individual and the privacy and the rights and the dignity of the individual. And he said that many, many times in his political career.
Well, let's switch gears and talk about your book, December 1941.
Okay.
Where did you get the idea to write this book? It's a day-by-day account of the 31 days of December.
My family, growing up, hearing all the stories about all the things that were going on with the Victory Gardens and the OYO and the fake coffee and the food shortages and all the sacrifices the American civilians made. My uncle was enlisted and was shot down and killed in the Pacific. Everybody in my family has always served in the military. I had two grandfathers who were at Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill in Boston. I had one uncle, my mother's great, or one grandfather, my mother's great-great-great-great-grandfather, who was with Washington all the way from 1775 to 1783. He was at Valley Forge. He contracted smallpox there and lost an eye. He was at Monmouth. He was at he was also at Boston. So he was at Trenton. So he was in a number of battles under Washington's command. He was just a militia who went into the regular army from Connecticut. I don't think he achieved any rank, but so everybody in my family's always served, and so I just, but I wanted to do something from the standpoint of the civilians and how they were affected by the events of December 7th.
What was your research process like? What was the method you used?
cast as wide a net as possible. We went to all the Roosevelt material and uncovered documents that hadn't been reported on previously. We went through Henry Stimson's papers at Yale. We went through Cordell Hull's papers. Cordell Hull was Secretary of State, of course. Eleanor Roosevelt's papers and diaries. All the White House documents we could get our hands on. All the War Department. And then on top of all that, memos, diaries, then we also went through thousands and thousands of newspaper articles, shortwave dispatches, because at the time is that CBS and NBC both had shortwave commercial broadcast stations. And so the transcripts of those shortwave broadcasts. And so I just went as far as possible to write a story about the 31 days of December 1941.
You mentioned the newspapers, newspaper clippings, and I think you used that for a lot of your reporting on the home front, what was going on culturally as well as politically. But as I recall reading your notes, I'm kind of geeky that way, that you only actually used a couple dozen local newspapers. How did you winnow it out? How did you decide to use a newspaper from Connecticut rather than one from Maine?
I guess it was what I thought would be more interesting to the reader, is ultimately, is that there were some ways, there were some reporters who were in columnists who were just terrific, and I liked to use them, their material. It's interesting that there probably wasn't a newspaper reporter in 1941 who wasn't an excellent writer. They were all very good writers, New York City at the time had 17, 19 daily newspapers, including ethnic papers, Polish papers, and Washington, I think, had 7 daily newspapers at the time. There were almost 2,000 daily newspapers. Now it's about 400 or 500. There were almost 2,000 daily newspapers in the United States in January and December of 41.
A lot more than there are today.
Yes.
My last question, I try to post this to authors whenever I get a chance, is as you were doing your research, what was the one thing that you discovered that was most surprising that you just didn't expect to come across?
I think coming to the conclusion that Franklin Roosevelt was a better man than I thought he was. I am a political conservative, but I'm also a historian, and I have to look at things objectively. Is the New Deal, in terms of, the standpoint of turning the economy around, was a failure. It did help the morale of the American people. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, is that there's also no doubt that without Winston Churchill and without Franklin Roosevelt, Adolf Hitler and the Empire of Japan would have ruled the known world without these men leading their countries. They really are part of, what Thomas Carlyle, the Scottish historian, postulated, the great man theory of history, and that these truly were great men.
Well, that's a great note to end on. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You bet, Rick. Thank you very much. You bet. Thank you.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember
Happy Hanukkah from The Score with Rick Sincere.
College campuses have always been hives of political activity, even as far back as the Middle Ages, when the concept of the university was first taking shape. Nowadays, you'll find groups of activist Republicans, Democrats, Socialists, and Libertarians, among others. At the University of Virginia, one group has been carrying the free market, free minds message for about three decades. It's called Students for Individual Liberty, and I spoke to its current president, Harrison Premen, to find out what he and his classmates are doing to promote the liberty movement. Tell me what the role is for a libertarian student organization in the 21st century.
Well, it kind of depends on the organization. Students for Individual Liberty at UVA, we kind of like to call ourselves more as a liberty organization instead of libertarian. Because as soon as you say libertarian, there's a lot of certain connotations, and some people try to link you to the Libertarian Party. We specifically try to be like a big tent idea of just advocating for like classical liberalism and just freer markets and freer people. This gives us a wide range of like being able to work with those on the left of us on like say social issues, those on the right of us on like economic issues, and just in general, just kind of promote what we kind of like that we support here in America, which is just a freer populace.
We're talking with Harrison Premen, who's a student at the University of Virginia and president of Students for Individual Liberty at UVA, or SIL. How did you get involved with this? When did you first become attracted to this type of organization?
So I've always been a very political person. As a young kid, I helped out with like my local Republican Party in my county of Fauquier. As the elections progressed, especially in 2016, I started becoming a little bit disenchanted with the direction of the party, and I ended up discovering Gary Johnson's campaign. I ended up becoming so involved in the Johnson campaign that I ended up joining a Who's for Gary Johnson group here at UVA. There was already Students for Individual Liberty at UVA, but I was not at that moment interacting with them. However, after the election, the Who's for Gary Johnson, of course, got dissolved because there was no point in having it. And so it was just SIL that was left, and they're the more philosophical debating and advocacy for liberty in general. They're non-political. I got more involved in that, and just like continuously being involved and advocating for their events and contributing ideas, ended up gaining a leadership spot on the executive council and then becoming president this year.
Do you find that students in general are open to the kinds of ideas that SIL presents and debates?
Yes, as soon as you get over the misconceptions people have, because a lot of times as soon as you say, like, oh, you're libertarian, or if you promote it in a certain way where it's in your face, people will immediately start getting those misconceptions they see on the internet about us being either unreasonable or radical or in your face just to get a rise out of someone. If you actually sit down and start discussing people, or at least cover the general basics, they will agree with you to some extent. In terms of policy, that's where there's a lot of debate, but in general, there's a lot of people who seem receptive to the idea of a general principle of more economic and social liberty.
What kind of programs do you have going this year? Are there speakers, debates, forums? What kinds of things are you doing?
So this year, it's been a bit of a restructuring. Though we do plan on hosting a few speakers, we're probably going to try to see if we can bring someone down from Cato or the America Center. We definitely are going to do a free speech tabling where we found a policy ed video, I think, on YouTube, and it's just about like how to go about free speech in terms of censorship and safe space and stuff like that. And we're going to try to host a little sidewalk thing where you'll get a cookie if you listen to this little video and discuss with us like your thoughts and feelings and how to go about it. But this whole academic year is more just about rebuilding the club and making sure that there's a dedicated group here on grounds to promote individual and economic liberty.
As compared to a lot of other colleges and universities around the country, the University of Virginia has a very good reputation when it comes to protecting the free speech rights of students. So would you agree with that?
In general, yes. They did, in response to the August 11th and 12th attacks, they did impose some restrictions on those who are not affiliated with the university at all. So if there was a group who had no connection to any CIO at UVA and wanted to host something, there are additional time, place, and manner regulations. Some people see that as a complete attack on freedom. Some people see it's extremely necessary. My concerns were, I understand the need for them to regulate the place and to know how many people, especially with what happened with the Unite the Right groups. I understand the universities need to know that stuff, but I personally had disagreements with certain select stuff, such as like only with X amount of time or only X amount of people. I feel like they might have gone overboard in certain places, but in general, I can kind of understand the rationale behind it.
Yeah, there's often a need for spontaneity when it comes to free speech events. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I would definitely say there needs to be a lot of spontaneity. Sometimes there's a little bit of bureaucracy red tape that you see at a lot of other universities, but it's nothing that you've seen where all of a sudden they're like restricting you to like a small free speech zone or whatever. For student organizations such as us, we have a wide range and wide latitude of availability. We have organizations that are on the very, very far left, organizations on the very, very far right. Well, sometimes there's a little bit of a drama with, say, the student council or like some bureaucratic thing here and there. In general, I say the University of Virginia does great with allowing students to exercise their freedom of speech.
Getting back to SILT, how do you interact with other student groups that focus on political issues like college Republicans or university Democrats or maybe Democratic Socialists of America or something like that? Do you interact with them at all?
So, as of this semester, we haven't much because, again, we've been going through restructuring, and a lot of us on the executive council have been very busy with a lot of personal and academic stuff. But we have in the past, like, either kind of co-host something or, like, we'll advertise events that align with our views and they'll advertise events that align with their views. Like, for example, we used to have, and we were planning on doing it again this upcoming spring, to host this thing. It was a huge criminal justice event.
Uh-huh.
And basically, we've had organizations who were willing to co-host and help bring in people or at least advertise for it. So that's kind of like how we usually kind of like work with other groups.
Yeah, and that bears out sort of nationwide. Criminal justice is something that is crossing party lines, ideological lines. You know, you've got the Koch brothers and George Soros both working on it at the same time, Rand Paul and Ron Wyden. So this is something where there can be a lot of synergy.
Yes, I definitely believe, and I'm a huge fan of building kind of like broad range coalitions and just being a wide open tent. After kind of like falling into the whole, at least me personally, falling into the whole, you know, party, like following the party, going along with the party, with both like the Republican and Libertarian parties, I kind of like took a step back, and I'm more of a fan of just a big tent, because there's a lot of things that in general we'll all agree upon, but if you try to start doing like ideological litmus tests, you'll start losing a whole lot of people, and you'll start kind of like diluting your goals to just being very specific and very ideological and impractical.
And where does SILT draw its members from? Is it a broad spectrum of majors and backgrounds from, you know, where people come from geographically?
Yes, we don't really. All we do is just advertise that we're having, you know, this event here, this event there. We're at the student activities fair in the fall. We just have a wide range of people from, like, say, the engineering school, the architecture school, such as myself, College of Arts and Sciences, all of these different people from all these different walks of life, etc.
And so what are your personal plans as far as SIL goes, you're going to graduate eventually. What do you have any plans on being involved in, you know, the liberty movement in general?
For myself, I have no idea after college. Depends on whether I do graduate school and what kind of job I land and where the job I land is. In terms of SIL, I'm only a third year, so I have at least one more year, assuming I don't do graduate school here. My goal is just to make sure we have a solid organization with a solid structure that will definitely stand multiple leadership transitions and will constantly put out events that just in general advocate economic and individual liberty.
We'll just wrap up here with where can people find out more about your organization? Do you have a website or Facebook?
We do have a Facebook page. It's actually, let me just pull it up real quick. Excuse me one moment while I pull out on my phone. I forgot this specific title because I think we've changed it once or twice beforehand. It's Students for Individual Liberty at UVA. And so it's like at SIL at UVA on Facebook.
Okay.
We don't have a Twitter. We don't really use our website. But we are active on the Facebook page, and definitely feel free to reach us through that.
Okay, well, Harrison, thank you for talking with me today. I appreciate your taking time out of your schedule just before exams, and it must be a very busy time, but thanks for meeting with me.
No problem. Thank you for interviewing me.
Happy holidays from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Here's a nugget from the archives. 7 years ago, on December 8, 2011, I spoke with Reason Magazine's movie critic, Kurt Loder, about his book of essays called The Good, the Bad, and the God-Awful, 21st Century Movie Reviews. A book like this might be a perfect stocking stuffer for the film lover in your life.
First, you know, tell me about your book in 30 seconds.
It's a collection of more than 200 movie reviews that I've done for MTV.com and Reason.com, my current employer, over the last 7 years. There are a lot of the usual blockbusters and stuff, but there are a lot of movies that people may have missed, like Exit Through the Gift Shop and The Fall. There's just so many good movies that come out, and if they don't make it the first week, they disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a lot of them in there, and there are a lot of movies which are really drivel.
Where did you get your interest in movies?
Like anybody else, we all love movies. Excuse me. Like one of the first movies I saw was The Thing in 1951. I've always loved movies, you know, and I think all of us do.
Have you studied movies from an academic standpoint, or are you right from the point of a fan?
I'm just a fan.
Just a fan?
Yeah, I'm not a film critic. I think film critics are like Pauline Kael and David Thompson and people like that who spent their entire lives in dark rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't done that. I try to keep up, and I see a lot of movies, but I have a disorganized knowledge. So I just see it if I like it or not. I try to be entertaining.
Do you think that popular culture has a great impact on politics, or is it the other way around?
Well, I think politics has an impact on all of us. I'm a lying one quite often. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't know how popular culture... Well, I suppose when you see people in Congress, you know, playing games on their laptops while Congress is in session.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of an impact, you know.
Well, better than making laws, right?
That's true. They shouldn't even be there. Send them home.
If somebody asks you, why should I buy this book? Why should I give this to somebody for Christmas? What's your selling point? What's the thing that's different about this book about movies than other movie books are?
It fits perfectly in a stocking. And I think it covers a lot of movies that you may have forgotten or never seen. And I tried to make it entertaining. So it's either entertaining or it's worthless. So I hope it's entertaining. And I think there's just a lot of movies that you might find in there that you might be, you know, inspired to go see.
Last question. What's your favorite film and why?
There's no such thing. The best movie I saw this year was The Tree of Life, which is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant movie. It's really, really good. Everybody should go see it.
Have you seen The Artist yet?
I have it at home on a screener.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard it's great.
I saw it at the Virginia
is
Film
good?
Festival. It's
I heard it was
genius.
Fabulous, yeah. I saw one last night, which is really good. Young Adult with Charlize Theron.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really good, too.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy very much, but a review just went up on Reason Online. There have been actually a lot of good movies at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
As
yes,
always.
Just look at the time. This week's episode of The Score has to close, but we'll be back next week with more news, reviews, and interviews. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere. Be sure to listen again and tell your friends where to find The Score. You can be part of the conversation, too. Just leave comments at BearingDrift.com.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BearingDrift.com.